Hi, welcome. You're listening to the Mike Exchange Podcast, brought to you by St. Michael's College. You'll hear from our larger community on various academic topics and how their experiences have driven them to where they are today.
Welcome to the St. Michael's College podcast, where we talk about a lot of things that we're studying, we're working on, what faculty are doing, what students are doing, and also what some alumni are doing after coming out of St. Michael's. So my name is Patrick Walsh, and I am an associate professor of economics at St. Michael's College. And today I'm joined by one of our alumni, Megan Olson. So she graduated in 2013 with a double major in economics and psychology. She then went on to get a master's degree in healthcare policy and is now working in the DC area. So she's doing some very cool things with her career. So Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I gave kind of the spoiler, I guess, of what your career has looked like since leaving St. Michael's. But you just kind of give a couple of details, how you ended up in the healthcare field, why you decided to get a master's degree.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, I graduated St. Mike's in 2013 with a double major in economics and psychology. And really within both econ and psych, I was really interested in healthcare and wellness and, in psychology more on the individual level and in economics more on the kind of macro and policy level. So kind of with those dual interests in mind, I was considering what sorts of career paths I wanted to go down, exploring various master degree programs, and I learned about the master's in public health degree. Did a lot of research into, what those look like, what types of careers you could come out of those with. I decided to pursue that degree coming straight out of St. Mike's. So I spent a lot of time junior and senior year sort of career-wise preparing for the GRE exam, applying to schools. Eventually decided to go to George Washington University here in D.C. So moved down to D.C. And really, as I started my master's program, got really interested in healthcare policy. Obviously, being here within D.C., there's a lot going on. There's a lot of attention on policy, a lot of people excited about policy. So I was able to secure an internship at a consulting firm called Avalier Health, where I really got that on the ground opportunity to dive into the pressing policy issues of the day. And during that time, it was all the Affordable Care Act was being implemented, and it was a really dynamic and changing time to see all of that happening both within the workplace, classroom, and sort of publicly too. So it really kind of drove my interest and helped me focus the rest of my master's degree program within health policy. And I got a few other internships and then actually got my first job coming out of the program back at Avalier, where I got that original internship. So, and I've been there since for about 6 years. So it's been a great journey. The great thing about health policy is that it's always changing.
Right.
There are always issues to solve. So it's been a really exciting time.
Cool. Now, it seems like a lot of the work that you've done at Avalier and, kind of a lot of the research and summaries that you've written have to do with kind of the intersection of employment and health insurance. So this is, for people who are not complete healthcare policy dorks like you and I, right? People over age 65 have Medicare, right? Which is it's basically a universal government insurance system for seniors. But then most people, under age 65, most people actually get their health insurance through either their employer or their spouse's employer, or if they're a kid, they get it through their parents' employer. Even before the craziness of COVID hit, could you talk a little about why that is? In the United States anyway, we have this link between employment and health insurance, and sort of how that was maybe changing and evolving over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a very interesting and kind of long-standing history to how we got to where we are in terms of the semi-fragmented health insurance system that we have today. If you go back to the end of the Second World War, there were wage controls put in place, and as a result, employers started to, you know, compete for employees and incentivize employees by offering health benefits. So that was sort of how it came into play, and the tax exemption for health benefits kind of continued to fuel that trend over the next few decades as employer-sponsored insurance rose. Then you had in 1965 the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid, as you mentioned. So Medicare primarily covering elderly adults over the age of 65, Medicaid, a state-administered program covering low-income individuals, and then you have most people with health insurance getting insurance through their employer today. Obviously, there are variations as you look at different sectors, different sizes of employers. There's different generosity in the benefits that are offered. So it's not sort of a one-size-fits-all offering, but a lot of people do access insurance through their employer today. There are also a good number of people that do not have insurance for a number of reasons. There are various coverage gaps that exist in different states that can leave people uninsured for various periods of time. But
yeah, and you know, even in the, you know, but before the ceiling fell in with the pandemic, you know, there was some changes and some you know, that ground was shifting at least a little bit, you know, in terms of where people, first of all, you know, who is uninsured, you know, where people are getting their insurance from, right? There it was with, in particular with Obamacare and kind of the rise of private individual insurance plans, right?
That's right. Yeah, so the ACA enacted in 2010, a few things to expand access to health insurance. One of them is through that individual market exchanges. About 10 million people have access through that. The other major component, which actually led to greater coverage gains, was the expansion of Medicaid in states. It was a state option to take up, so not all states have since expanded eligibility for low-income individuals in their Medicaid programs, but about 35 states in DC have so far, and a few are still considering it. So, you know, since the ACA, there has been an increase in insurance coverage. There are still people that remain uninsured, but there have certainly been some gains there. But you raised a good point, bringing up COVID. You know, we talked about how so many people access insurance through their job. One of the biggest things that we've seen as a result of COVID and the economic effects is that millions of Americans have been losing their jobs. And this has been occurring over the past few months. And as we look ahead, could persist for, you know, a good amount of time. And it's uncertain to what level economically we could, you know, return to normal. But as people lose their job, in many cases, they also lose that employer-based health insurance. And as a result, could either become uninsured for a period of time. They could find other sources of coverage through the individual market. They also might qualify for Medicaid, particularly since they have lost their job, and as a result, their income decreases. But what we're really seeing is sort of an additional fragmentation of the market, where you have people shifting in and out of different forms of coverage, which certainly creates challenges for continuity of care and access, things like that.
Yeah, and you know, when you compare, you know, the system that we have, where most non-seniors, you know, have that insurance coverage through their employer. You know, I remember, you know, even in the class that I teach at Sam Michaels on economics of healthcare, you know, even before the pandemic, you talk about, okay, so yeah, you know, it's great if you're employed and you're healthy, but you know, what if somebody gets a really bad like cancer diagnosis and they're too sick to work? Well, now they've lost their job because they're sick, and they've also lost their insurance coverage because they're sick. And as you said, there's you know, if they have a spouse that can get coverage, you know, that's one thing. If not maybe, you know, that might qualify for Medicaid, but it's sort of, you know, compounding risk rather than, you know, rather than eliminating it or spreading it. And then, you know, with the COVID situation, you know, it's kind of the other way around. I mean, I'm sure there are people who, you know, that, you know, got COVID and were unable to work, but many, many millions more, like you were saying, lost their jobs just because they had to lock down the economy. You know, now those people have a big interruption in their insurance. Right when we have this, like, you know, century epic pandemic coming through. So yeah, so it's and even if people do, and this is something I think, you know, you probably have a better handle on, you know, with your research. But, you know, even if people do sort of find a lifeboat, whether, you know, it's you know, through a spouse's insurance or, you know, they qualify for Medicaid or, you know, they use the insurance exchanges, you know, that's far from seamless. I mean, there, for a lot of these cases, you know, there's only, you know, there's kind of this window of time once a year when you can sign up for that insurance. So, you know, if you lose your insurance after that window's closed, you've got to wait maybe a year, you know, for the to sign up for the alternative.
Yeah, that's right. And there's actually been policy discussions around opportunities to open up that open enrollment period in the individual mm-hmm. market, for instance, to allow people, you know, a special enrollment period in the context of the pandemic. But yeah, to your point, you know, there are so many variations in terms of what people are experiencing right now when losing employer-sponsored coverage and what options are available to them. Someone in one state will have a certain set of options and it might look very different from someone living in another state, just because of the sort of state and federal framework.
Yeah, and that was actually going to be my next question. So, you know, even opening up those sort of, you know, windows of opportunity to sign up for coverage, that's something that would probably vary tremendously from state to state, right?
That's what we see in a lot of aspects of healthcare, right? So, you know, not just allowances for special enrollment periods, but expansion of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. It's very different state to state. A person with the same income in one state might be eligible for Medicaid, but in another state is not. The number of health plans being offered in a certain state on the exchanges varies by state, the premium offerings. And there are a lot of state policy decisions that, you know, impact the type of coverage that someone could receive too, such as, you know, benefit mandates for certain types of services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking, just kind of zooming in a little bit on the Obamacare ACA state-based exchanges. So, as you mentioned before, you know, but before the COVID ceiling fell in, there was, you know, on the order of about 10 million Americans who got their health insurance there. And I guess the analogy that, you know, I make in the, you know, I teach class is that's actually a framework of people sort of buying their own health insurance rather than relying on an employer. They go, it's kind of like, you know, going up and buying health insurance the way, you know, we would ordinarily buy homeowners insurance or auto insurance. Do you have an idea how COVID might affect the stability of those markets? Because I know, for, you know, like you're saying, varies tremendously from state to state. But, you know, for a while there was some concern that you could get sort of an adverse selection story where, you know, it was the people who were kind of sicker, kind of lower income, were going to be more costly for the insurance companies. You know, the concern was those were going to be the people, or those were the people signing up for these exchanges, which would then raise premiums, which would then, you know, incentivize the healthier people to drop out and you get this, you know, kind of doom loop. That didn't really materialize in most places, but I'm curious if there's been any thinking about, you know, how the pandemic could affect that dynamic, either positively or negatively, right? It can go in two directions.
Yeah, that's a really good question. As I think back to the 2014-2015 timeframe when the exchanges were launching, everything was new, there wasn't a lot of experience with this population, and you know, there wasn't a good understanding of who was going to enroll, how many people were going to enroll. And what we saw early on was a good amount of instability. So a lot of insurers underpriced the premiums. There wasn't a great expectation or understanding of the, you know, medical needs of this population, and turned out to be needier than expected. What seemed to drive enrollment more so than anticipated was premium price, which isn't entirely unexpected, but I think more so than folks anticipated. And there are various tax credits and subsidies available to individuals with certain income levels, which drove certain enrollment decisions. I think after a few years of experience on the exchange market, you know, some issuers decided to leave the market, others entered. There was sort of a bit of entry and exit there. But over the last few years, things have stabilized a bit, which has been supported by some policy changes, certainly. And it's held steady enrollment around 10 million. I think as we think about the impact of COVID on the exchange market and sort of insurance overall, I think one of the big impacts is this level of churn of people moving in and out of insurance plans, out of employer-sponsored to the individual market. Maybe someone then regains a job and then they switch back to employer-sponsored coverage. And this is certainly a challenge for issuers who are, you know, looking to manage costs and across the entire benefit year, however, might not hold enrollees for that long. Another thing that they're seeing is changes in utilization patterns. So, you know, especially early on in the pandemic, a lot of providers, you know, had to pause a lot of the services or surgeries that they were offering, which led to delays and gaps in care overall. So I think what we're seeing in insurance is, you know, there was certainly a decrease in utilization and services in the near term, and to some extent that continues to persist in certain areas. But it's interesting to think about, you know, longer term, what is the impact of some of those gaps in care or delays in accessing preventive care? What will be the ramifications in a few years?
Yeah. Like, so in the short run, you know, people are staying away from their primary care doctors, you know, and they're, you know, not getting screenings. And yeah, that's one of those, you know, over the course of, you know, months or quarters, you know, that shows up pretty well for the insurers, right? It's less cost for the insurers. But then the question is, you know, if we're, you know, missing somebody's cancer diagnosis or, you know, missing somebody's hypertension or something like that, then it could be more costly in the long run. What has your organization and kind of your work, you know, what kind of models or what kind of, you know, policies have you been, you know, working on in terms of, you know, going forward, you know, sort of alternatives or, you know, sort of thinking about, you know, ways, you know, I think politically it seems like it would be hard to kind of nuke the whole thing and start over, you know, kind of gotta start from where we are. But, you know, what kind of work have you guys been doing on, you know, some tinkerings that could push in the right direction?
Yeah, so we've been very focused in this space, and, you know, for context, Avalier is a consulting firm. We work with pretty much all of the stakeholders across the healthcare industry, primarily life sciences companies, health insurance companies, providers, a lot of trade organizations and advocacy organizations as well. But we've been doing a lot of work focused on what are the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on their businesses. What are some policy changes that could help offset some of the challenges that stakeholders are facing today? And then kind of looking further ahead, what are some business strategies that they could pursue to proactively, you know, protect against some of the challenges that they're facing or advance new opportunity, move into different business lines, things like that. I think, you know, what we're seeing is this is impacting different stakeholders in different ways. And, you know, the shift of people into different insurance plans creates challenges, not just for insurance companies, but also drug companies, as people might have drug coverage under one plan, but then their drug isn't covered under another plan. Mm-hmm. You have providers that, had a lot of reduction in services that they were offering, and potentially were able to access some of the provider relief funds from the federal government. So there's been, a lot of different things that we've been focused on. I think in particular, two I would flag is one, we've been doing analytics to model the impact of coverage loss or the impact of job loss on insurance market shifts. So as people lose their insurance, what markets do they lose it from and what markets might they move to? So obviously this is happening real time and there's no sort of really good data out there to verify, but we have a pretty robust modeling and analytics team that has built this out and has been really helpful to work with the stakeholders that we support to, help project what the business impact to them might look like. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would flag is we've been doing a lot of thinking on what is the impact what is the impact of the election that is upcoming on the future of policy changes related to COVID and not related to COVID. Right. That could impact the healthcare space.
Yeah. And that's which just kind of, reminds me, I do get, whether it's students or parents or, friends and relatives who are like, hey, you're an economist, what's going to happen with the economy? Like I've been asked by the kind of marketing team at St. Mike's, the admissions team to, put together some of these, presentations about it. But, really what it boils down to is first tell me what's going to happen with the pandemic. And then, I might possibly have an idea what could happen with the economy.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think we don't even really have good visibility on what the trajectory of that pandemic's going to look like. So just to sort of recap, it sounds like not surprising given sort of the clients that your firm works with. It seems like you're really kind of focused, really kind of on the next couple months, next couple quarters, next year or so, in terms of predicting kind of the, I guess what they would call sort of the higher frequency kind of changes, and that, any sort of modeling or any sort of consulting on bigger systemic changes is sort of like, okay, can we have the house not be on fire before we start planning how to remodel it? Yeah. Could you, almost kind of in closing, for, some of our listeners who might be college students, might be St. Mike's students, or even might be high school students, looking at colleges. If you could give sort of some advice in turn, if they're sort of interested in healthcare policy, they're not necessarily want to be a doctor or a provider, but they're sort of interested in just sort of how this whole crazy machine that we have, how it works and how it can be improved. What sort of advice, both I guess academically and also in terms of career, would you give to those students?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, personally, I didn't know exactly that I would be landing in the role that I did now. I don't think I really knew that this type of role existed before I kind of jumped into it. So I think anyone that's listening to this is a step ahead of where I was. I think, exploring what you're interested in, taking a wide range of classes, finding out what really sticks with you, what really makes you excited about learning, makes you ask additional questions, and then really doing your research. I remember spending a ton of time in the library pouring through books on career advice. I remember reaching out to a bunch of alumni and being able to talk with them about their career paths, what it's like working in consulting, things like that, and everyone was very helpful. I also think that pursuing internship or job opportunities is great. Even if you don't think it's the perfect fit, I was able to do a few different internships, both in my time at St. Mike's as well as at my time at GW. And while some of those don't directly relate to what I do now. They were incredible learning experiences and helped point me towards what types of things I wanted to do. So I would say keep an open mind, but definitely do a lot of diligence into the types of things you're interested in. Don't be afraid to reach out to alumni or even people that are working at organizations you're interested in. And I would say particularly within the health policy space, there are so many organizations and news sources releasing really good information on a regular basis. So tune into that, you know, stay updated.
Kaiser Family Foundation, just like.
They are great.
Subscribe to their website and just, yeah, everything. I taught economics of healthcare this past spring, and you know, when I was putting together all the readings, you know, at some point I was just like, you know, why am I even teaching this? I could just, you know, say, guys, read everything on this website, and you know, you're gonna get what you need. Well, Megan, thank you so much. This was a great conversation, and I think you'd be interested to know that kind of all of these conversations we've had so far. So I've talked with three alumni so far. And each one of them, kind of in their own different ways, has basically said, you know, follow your passion, do what you're interested in, you know, listen to what you find interesting and also what you don't find interesting, right?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Thank you again for having me. This is a great conversation. Great to reconnect.
Yeah. Now the last little bit, I do have to embarrass Megan. She's way too. Way too humble. In addition to being an absolute complete monster of a student at St. Mike's, and you know, it seems like it only continued through graduate school and stuff like that. She was also in her senior year Division II All-American for the basketball team at St. Michael's College. So I can verify she is a utter and complete nerd with all this healthcare stuff, and she's also quite the jock as well. So that's kind of a great mix.
I appreciate that.
Probably don't get a lot of chance to get back on the court these days. Or
not these days. I have actually been playing more soccer than basketball more recently. But
yeah, DC has a very, very active kind of pickup soccer or rec soccer.
Oh yeah, there's tons of sports teams and opportunities.
People doing that. All right. Well, it was great to talk. And this is the St. Michael's podcast. We'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mike Exchange. If you're interested and want to learn more, check out our other episodes.